Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
How do you feel sitting alone with your thoughts? Do you wander off into cerebral adventures if you're sitting at the bus stop or in the waiting room at the doctor's? Or are you someone who can just sit with themselves? If you look around on the streets, you'll find many of us cannot. We're all looking at our smartphones, we're scrolling the latest social media feeds, seeing who's on holiday where, perhaps just trying to forget the humdrum of everyday life. I sometimes think it's amusing if you're on your own to look around if people are seated around you to see how many noses are in telephones. Here's a sobering fact. A study from Harvard University found that 2/3 of men and 1/4 of women would rather sit in the room getting sharp electrical shocks than be alone with their own thoughts. But what about the joys of solitude? I know many of you have experienced stressful times being in lockdown, but we're not talking about that. This is about people like Bernard Mortessier, the solo yachtsman, who, rounding Cape Horn in a strong position to win the first Golden Globe race in 1968, decided it'd be more fun to sail on, back round the Cape of Good Hope a second time and into the Pacific again. Or Tenzin Palmo, the UK-born Buddhist nun who spent 12 years alone in a cave in the Himalaya. What is solitude and how is it different to loneliness? Joining me is Christine Jackman, journalist and author of the new book, Turning Down the Noise, The Quiet Power of Silence in a Busy World. Christine, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Oh, great to be here, Philip. Thanks for having
me. Fantastic to have you with us. Also joining us from, quite a way away, is Sarah Maitland. Sarah is in southwest Scotland, in Stranraer, Dumfries and Galloway in the United Kingdom, which I think you can't get to very quickly. Sarah, good evening to you and welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you. Nice to be social. Thank you.
Well, yes, exactly. Tell us where you are, Sarah.
Well, I'm on the south coast of Scotland, which most people don't even know exists. But there's a bit of Scotland that sticks out in the very bottom left-hand corner. And as far west as you want to go, that's where I live.
Wow.
I can see Ireland from the coast.
How do you get to where you are, Sarah?
How do I get there? In my car. How do most people get there? It is difficult, to be honest. You can go to Glasgow and catch a single-track train which bumbles its way down. You could cross the border from England and turn left on what must be one of the worst roads in Britain. The A75 is famously overused because it is the way you go to Northern Ireland.
Sarah, I tell you what, you are in terrific solitude there, Sarah, so much so that our phone line's a bit dodgy. I tell you what, I'll just put you on hold. We'll try and get back to you and see if we can improve the line there or lay some new cable. Solitude, of course, sometimes means bad phone lines, I guess. Christine, just over to you two. What is solitude anyway?
Wow, such a big question, Philip.
Yeah. I thought I'd start with a small one.
I began my book looking at one of solitude's twin sisters, I guess you could call it, which is silence. And I found very quickly that these sorts of concepts, it's very risky and wrong-headed to try and nail them down to one particular thing, because often one of the key differences is that our experience of them will change remarkably if they're imposed on us versus whether we choose them freely. Mm. And if you think about that with solitude, if you put in solitary confinement, for example, or indeed as possibly some of your listeners are experiencing, that, you know, they're on their own at home at night and maybe, you know, they'd prefer not to be, you know, they're a long way from family or things like that, then solitude can take on quite a dark and negative vibe. And of course that we're talking there about physical solitude. And I would argue that there's also a sense that you can be, you know, alone with your thoughts, that you can find a quiet internal solitude with some training, even when you have busyness around you. And you only have to look at, you know, the monasteries in places, some of the busiest cities of Asia, you know, to discover that while those traditions will often have times for the monks where they will go to forests or to deserts or so forth, a lot of the time they are practicing in very noisy surrounds and with other people around them. But there you're seeking a sort of a solitude where you may, for example, retire to what they call a cell or a bedroom, but you're basically finding space and quiet for your own thoughts and to be alone with yourself and arguably with your God, if that's part of the training.
If that's part of what it is as well. Just Sarah, back to you, Sarah Maitland in southwest Scotland. What do you think solitude is, Sarah?
Being on your own and liking it, really. You know, I think Wordsworth had got it right. It is for those people who discover by various means, which we could discuss, how to access it. It is bliss, the bliss of solitude. It's the nicest and most wonderful thing, at least for short periods of time, to enjoy. The problem is that we're not very good at it.
What's the longest you've been on your own, Sarah?
40 days.
Okay.
Well, actually, it turned out to be 42 days because it took me rather a long time to get home for reasons I wasn't going to.
Was that? Had you had enough of it by then?
No, but it was a very. It's complicated, isn't it? We've been in lockdown in Scotland because of the coronavirus since February. Well, since March, to be precise. So I've probably spent longer periods than that alone. But I somehow don't think about it because it's not organised. Do you see what I mean? There are standard retreats. 40 days is a famous one, and it seems not accidentally chosen. It's a good length of time.
What about you, Christine? What's the longest period you've been alone, on your own?
Well, you're talking to the mother of two teenage boys.
That's never happened.
I can't, exactly.
I didn't really take to silence till Mum had grown up, you know.
Yes. Sarah, your book was a great inspiration to me, actually.
Thank you.
Philip, I've managed 10-day silent retreats.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to explore longer, but, you know, with all of these things, you know, it really is a matter of, you know, what your other obligations and, you know, where you're at in life, to put it that way.
We often see, Christine, go on, Sarah.
Can I just say quickly here?
Yeah.
I don't think the two are actually exactly in conflict. I think that, you know, I mean, we take Wordsworth, who talks about the bliss of solitude. He lived very happily with other people. He was well known to be kind of well socialized and had lots of friends. So it's not that you either spend time with your small children or you live in total silence. It's how you weave through your life those experiences of solitude that don't make you lonely, and how you weave that into a whole life.
What do you spend time with, Sarah? Do you listen to the radio? Do you read?
I read quite a lot. I find when I'm really working on silence, I live on my own, all right? I live on my own very, very rurally. My nearest neighbour is, well, I'm probably actually, of course, in Australia, you know more about that than I do, but it's very unusual in Britain to live more than a mile from your next door.
Yes, exactly.
I set it up. I made it easy for myself to be alone. I live in a very desolate.
Sarah, tell me, do you listen to the radio?
No, I don't get very good radio. I don't have a television.
Do you listen to? Do you have a computer connection?
I have a computer connection, but it's silent. I have a very interesting thing. There are 5 million people in Britain who cannot access full broadband, who cannot access a mobile phone signal, and I'm one of them.
Okay, so no mobile phone, no internet.
No mobile phone.
No internet connection.
I have got an internet connection. It's just a bit slow. For example, I have not been able to use Zoom during the lockdown.
Yeah.
I have. It's called inadequate bandwidth.
I know. We're talking with Sarah Maitland, who's the author of A Book of Silence and How to Be Alone, and Christine Jackman, author of a new book, Turning Down the Noise, The Quiet Power of Silence in a Busy World. And we're talking about the notion of solitude and being alone. Christine, we seem to be in a world where we're more connected than ever before, but also lonelier than ever before. Have we forgotten how to be friends with each other, with ourselves?
With ourselves, absolutely. I mean, I find it sort of quite ironic that we live in the era of the selfie, and yet, as you quoted with the Harvard study, you know, most of us would rather, or according to that study, a good chunk of us would prefer to give ourselves an electric shock than sit alone with our thoughts for any amount of time. And I think that's come from, we've been distanced from ourselves and our inner lives, because we are now living in a world where technology provides constant really infinite distraction. You don't have to sit with your thoughts. You don't have to get to know yourself.
Mm.
You don't have to entertain yourself with your own imagination, or indeed, as we're seeing with young people, actually go out and explore the physical world. Because from, you know, the end of the first decade of this century, about 2007, I believe, we've had smart devices, mobile devices. And it feels like a lot longer, doesn't it? But as a result, we're seeing, a young generation who really don't feel like they need to actually go out into the external world to explore it, because there's stuff on the screen, 24/7. And I would argue that has had a big impact on how well we know ourselves, and indeed how well our brain can cope with just processing, what's going on around us, let alone our own thoughts and emotions.
Mm. Yes, maybe there are some people, Sarah, who are just better. And to you too, Christine. I mean, maybe there are some people who are better at this than others. Introverted people do tend to like their own company perhaps a bit more. I mean, extroverts get their energy from other people. Is it as simple as that, do you think, Sarah?
I think it starts much earlier. I think that I don't know how it is again in Australia, but in Britain, the most popular punishment for primary age children is to send them to their bedroom alone.
Yes. Go to your room. Yes.
Go to your room. I don't know if that's a common punishment, but it is now, since people, I am glad to say, have stopped whacking their children. It's now our most popular punishment. Well, of course you grow up thinking being alone is a miserable experience if you only get it as a punishment. No-brainer. But I would want to push that further.
Well, it's a bit hard, Sarah, to say go and sit in front of the television for an hour.
No, come and help Mummy do the washing up. Seems to me, or you will cook supper for us all because you have been so naughty.
I see.
I need Sarah in my house.
Or there's lots of things you could do. There's lots and lots of things you could do. Go and do some of this. If you haven't lucky enough to have one, go and do some reading. Go and help your father in the garage.
I get what you're saying, yeah, all right.
And I would push that further and say there is a real problem in Britain at least about the terrifying level to which we feel children must be supervised.
Mm.
The fact is that stranger danger, except for the hideous year of Dunblane, and then the children and what were meant. Dunblane was a schoolyard massacre that we had.
Yes. Yes, we've heard it made international news, and we heard it.
Yeah. Right. Well, that was awful. But what's interesting about it, it was the one place where the children were supposed to be safe.
Hmm.
Other than that, the stranger danger risks have not really changed since the 1950s. But in the 1950s, people let their kids go out to play outside alone, let them do unsupervised things. I have a neighbour, fairly neighbour, who lives 5 miles away. And I met him one day, and he was very sad. And I said, "Why are you sad?" And he said, "There are conkers on the road being squashed by cars. When I was a boy, a conker didn't stay on the road. Past school time, because people went out and got them in order to play with them, you know." And I think that idea that children are frightened of or not allowed to practice being alone is really, really culturally different.
How do you respond to that, Christine? Because after all, you've got kids. What are you thinking about that?
I've got grown ups.
Would you put that into practice?
To go to the original point about whether or not you can send a child to the room. The interesting thing is sending a child to the room now is completely ineffective unless you take their screens off them. I think the most common punishment now is you lose your device or you lose all screens because
you're going to live in Southwest Scotland.
Yeah, exactly. But Philip, I think I agree that that ability to be with oneself, yes, there are people who are introverts, there are people who are extroverts. I would argue that there are people who can straddle both. I mean, I enjoy having conversations like this and enjoy seeing groups of people, but I also need, I find the need for quality, quiet time is critical for creative thought, for deep strategic thought when I was giving strategic advice in my role as a communications executive. And they're the sorts of things that are being taken away from us. So I think that in all sorts of ways, from childhood now, we are losing the ability to just sit still without stimulation. And I think that's probably another great way of defining solitude is, to find a place that is pared back of stimulation, whether it be human interaction or digital noise, as I talk about in my book, and just be with ourselves and our thoughts. And what that allows us to do is, to replenish, so that even if we are an extrovert or we do like, getting out into the world, we've replenished ourselves, just rested our brains, our emotional energy and so forth. And then, of course, if you are doing different sorts of work, whether it's, a big assignment for children or studying or, as I said, creative work, the work of writing or the work of creating art or indeed the strategic work, the deep problem solving that we need from our leaders, this stuff requires, deep work, as the author Cal Newport puts it, quiet time. And increasingly, from very early age right up, we don't have that anymore. We don't have it because, digital noise particularly is ubiquitous. Work can find us anywhere now. We can find distraction anywhere. And so, in all sorts of ways, I think whether, again, to go back to your original point, whether you are naturally more outgoing or naturally more introverted, across the spectrum, none of us are getting that replenishing, quiet downtime that we used to in as a great proportion as we used to.
I'm sure that's right.
I think that's right too.
Yeah.
I think that's right.
All right. Christine, just 1 second, Sarah. Christine Jackman's my guest. She's the author of her book's called Turning Down the Noise, The Quiet Power of Silence in a Busy World. Sarah Maitland's author of A Book of Silence and How to Be Alone. She's speaking to us tonight from a remote part of southwest Scotland where she lives on her own. Sarah, what do you do all day? There's only so many times you can wash up the breakfast things, I imagine.
I'm laughing because that is a question that you're always asked. What does anyone do the whole time? They waste time. I sit around, I think it would be a really good idea if I cleaned my living room. which I can think about for 45 minutes, and I have not cleaned my living room, I probably do almost exactly what everyone else does, except talk a lot to other people. I mean, it's a joke around here. When we were having our lockdown, you were supposed to keep social distance. I don't know how you handled it. So you were supposed to stay 2 metres away from everybody else. out of the car window, I talked to one of the other people who live up this extremely remote valley, and she said, I haven't seen anyone to breach social distancing with for 3 weeks. And that makes it a lot easier, you know.
Sarah, you've evaded my question here with all due... I want to know what you do all day, because if there's nobody to talk to, what?
Okay, yeah. I pray a lot.
Yes.
Mostly silently, but I do use formal prayer, for example, the Psalter. I probably do that for certainly more than an hour, and ideally around about 2 hours a day.
Yep.
I read quite a lot, which is a really interesting one, because I think you could argue that that wasn't being silent. But I still do it. I write some really brilliant books, which is why radio programs in Australia ring me up at crack of dawn to talk to me. I believe, deeply believe, that silence is a necessary part of what we normally call artistic creativity. I honestly do, and that does seem to have been the experience for generations.
Why do you say that there's an argument that reading is not being quiet?
It's a question exactly what silence is, because if it's access to language, then obviously reading isn't. Isn't silent. I think it is silent myself. But I do know that some people have argued very interestingly that it isn't.
Yeah. What do you think about that? What do you think about that one, Christine? Is reading silence or not?
Again, it depends on what, I guess, the point in some ways of the silence is. Vipassana retreat, which is a 10-day silent retreat, one of the most difficult rules about it was no reading and no writing materials. And that, I discovered very quickly, was far more difficult for me to cope with than not speaking. And that goes to what Sarah was talking about, because you're still engaging with the words and ideas and the language, you know, of somebody else. And if the purpose is to really get down, really quiet your own mind really deeply, and as a practice that's often, you know, meditative or prayerful or contemplative, then you actually want to take all of those things away. And I wouldn't, you know, that's obviously not something that most people would live with all the time. I find reading, you know, I've really embraced reading in a way that that I wouldn't. I've scaled back screens dramatically since I wrote the book. But I find reading very, very soothing. But for that really deep contemplative practice, really accessing the well of ourselves, and yes, to take everything away is really quite, it provokes some really remarkable reactions. And I also have to say, one of the most amazing things, you were thinking there, I think, when you were asking Sarah, what do you do with your time? Well, the fascinating thing is, when we clean all the grime off our senses, what I mean by that is all the overstimulation, you know, all of the, we're usually so overstimulated that we don't even notice when we add something more to the mix. When you've cleaned that all off, it is amazing how much you can do with your time, because you're like this. Every sense unfurls when you walk. I remember taking a walk during my Vipassana retreat, because that was the only sort of exercise we could do. And mind you, you didn't get very, very much time to do it, because you spent up to 10 hours in the meditation hall. But I remember walking, you know, really slowly and just observing not just the different way the breeze was hitting me, but then the different way the light was hitting the leaves in the trees. And then one of the best moments was coming across an echidna, and I could have followed that echidna for hours, because it was just as I said, you've slowed down to a point where you're appreciating the detail around you. And it, you know, if you've ever seen people who've been camping off grid for a while, sitting around a campfire at night, it's like you suddenly realise that campfire, that's the world's first TV. The different light, the different sounds, the different, you know, you can, your brain switches on to these things because it's actually suddenly like a windshield that's been, you know, when you've cleaned it.
Oh, yeah. I know some bushies who lived in the bush most of their lives who describe the open fire as bush TV, but they don't say it in a very kind, they don't say it in a very kindly way. My guests tonight, Christine Jackman, whose book, Turning Down the Noise, The Quiet Power of Silence in a Busy World. And Sarah Maitlands, the author of A Book of Silence and How to Be Alone. Sarah lives in the remote part of southwest Scotland. Sarah, do you listen to music during the day?
I don't actually listen to music because I have a completely separate little problem in life, which is I'm turned down.
Uh-huh, okay.
Music does absolutely nothing for me except make a noise. I have been all my life. And it's a pain, it's a bore, because I think listening to music has been very, very important to a lot of people who have sought solitude and silence, and it's just one I have to do without.
Yeah.
But quickly, just going back to what do I do all day, somehow I didn't get to say, which is what you just reminded me about, is being in nature, walking, looking. One of the great things about living somewhere as isolated as this is that I see birds that people haven't seen in 50 years. I mean, you know, it is flowers. We don't have many trees because it's open moorland here. You know, foxes, that stuff. That if you cannot see that stuff unless you are silent, so it kind of encourages you. As well as being, as you were saying,
yes,
emotionally, a very extraordinary thing. Being outside, alone, in silence, is an extraordinary experience. If you do it for 5 minutes, if you're more sociably inclined than I am.
Yeah.
And if you do it for day, my son, I should just be polite to say, is a big solo trekker. And he says one of the things that has made his life more enjoyable is having a pack donkey. Because then the pack donkey doesn't talk, but you're not completely alone.
Yes, there's
called Martin.
I guess pack
donkey do these enormous walks together.
All right, there you go. A pack donkey. Let's take a call or two as well. Mark from Baker's Creek. G'day, Mark.
Hey, g'day, Phil.
Hi.
I was just talking about that lady who was talking about solitude and everything.
Yeah.
I've been here for probably 16 years. I've had a few girlfriends and everything, but it doesn't matter. That I've been here in solitude for 16 years, but I've grown an orchard. I've got heap of chooks, you know. I've got beautiful banners. I've got ducklings everywhere. I've got lychee trees, macadamias. Who needs superannuation, Phil?
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Mark. That's true too. Most of us probably is the answer, given the circumstances we find ourselves in. G'day, Eric.
G'day, Phil. How are you going?
Not bad.
I've been very interested in Christine and Sarah's comments because I've been working with young people for about 40 years and a lot of outdoor education and, I usually take high school groups out classes to experience the outdoors, nature and the environment and working together. And I've found that time alone, that where they can't see another person, but just sitting quietly, staying within their area, has been probably the most popular part, the kids say, of the week that they have. And I got the idea from Outward Bound, which has, like, I think 3 weeks of outdoor activities and abseiling and canoeing and all the rest of it, very physical. But they also have 3 days of total solitude. And the research said that the most enjoyable part of their experience in Outward Bound was the 3 days of solitude. So it sort of says something about, from my experience, that kids love, well, they need to be exposed to that experience, and they love it when they get the opportunity to experience it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, this is something, Christine, I suppose that, you know, you would say in relation to kids today that they don't get that many opportunities to do this.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I'm always careful to sort of say, you know, people have been saying since, you know, human beings probably walked the earth, people have been complaining about their kids, right? Mm. And I don't want to sort of say kids these days, they can't entertain themselves, but I think what your caller's saying and what I would say is that, you know, we are sort of blasting them in a way with more stimulation, sort of more overscheduled activities, all that sort of thing than they've ever, than any kids ever experienced. You lose your ability to, one, simply be, but then I would argue, and I think we're all sort of saying it in different ways about nature, that experience of allowing your senses to unfurl. You know, I sort of describe myself in the book at one point as being so tightly coiled. You know, you're in an office, you know, in front of a computer. You know, the boxes are getting smaller and smaller, and everything is curled and tight, you know, responding to that sort of stimulation. You put yourself outside or put a kid outside, you know, in wide open space. And what fairly quickly happens is we return to what we are from an evolutionary perspective. You know, for most of our time on Earth, human beings have been animals who've been, you know, responding to nature and responding to the rhythms of season and the sun. And something about, you know, our brain, our nervous system, at the human body, you know, that muscle memory, that memory is still there. You know, we like it, we tune into it, and you can very quickly get a sense of well-being. But with most kids these days, you first have to get them through what's a fairly vicious withdrawal. And I use those words, you know, deliberately, from their devices, because, you know, we're learning now that they are like a poker machine, you know, constantly stimulating the neural pathways in their brain.
Yeah, I wonder whether it's even a remotely practical proposition that you can separate them from. Yeah. Sorry, Sarah, you were jumping in here.
Yes, I am jumping in here because our kids don't have mobiles. There is no mobile signal within 10 miles of here. Seriously, and the children, there aren't a lot of them, but they have to go to school on the bus for quite a long way to get to it, and they can all tell you exactly the point in the road when you get a signal. It's about 4 miles below the village. And I do think it's hard for them. I think it's hard for them, you know, when they come home in the evening, they have to be on the bus or they can't get home. And as soon as they're on the bus, they will lose their mobile signal. And I do think it's difficult, but the fact is, we have very low youth crime, we have very little drug problem. You know, because they're quite used to living.
Yeah, I know. That may be, Sarah, due to a low range of other factors as well. Sarah Maitland's with us, lives not on her own, well, pretty much on her own, in southwest Scotland, and Christine Jackman as well. Just a few texts here too. We're not talking, of course, about issues of anxiety and loneliness, which, of course, is in a sense a separate conversation. But Liz in North Sydney says, silence is hell if you have tinnitus. I used to love the quiet. Not since I got tinnitus. No, tinnitus can be a dreadful, dreadful thing. Glenn says, I live alone. I'm a sole resident of Scadden, a town in WA. When I turn off the generator, my thoughts are mine, and the silence of the night truly allows you the time to get to know yourself and the love of life. David in Melbourne says, I'm finding the subject matter disturbing. I live alone and have just gotten through one of the most terrifying times of my life, having to stay home and isolate. Silence, yeah, is not... Silence is the last thing that I want. Ash says, I'm loving this interview on solitude. I live alone by choice. I love solitude and my peaceful existence. I love catching up with people I love, but I don't feel a need to have lots of contact with anyone. I like working with my hands. I still work full-time, and I love going home to total silence. We've lost touch with that in some way, haven't we, Sarah? We've lost touch with the benefit of silence.
I think we've lost touch with both the benefits of it and the extreme scariness of it when you first try it out.
Mm.
But I'm not questioning for one moment that people have had a terrible time during our lockdown, because they have never in their lives been on their own for 24 hours.
Yeah.
You know, I can absolutely think it is something that you need to practice. You know, exactly as you do reading. Look how long it took to teach you to read. There's an entire structure in this country to make sure that children learn to read. There is no structure to make sure they learn to enjoy being on their own.
It is an important point. We should probably acknowledge that, yes, there is... For people who either have pre-existing sort of mental health issues, or indeed sometimes, you know, deep, deep silence. And I think Sarah wrote about this in your book at one point. You know, if you spend a lot of time in deep silence, you will come across, you know, you can become destabilized. You can have the long dark night of the soul.
Mm.
And in fact, if you're going into a 10-day retreat, as I did, you will be screened for pre-existing mental health issues, because, as Sarah was saying, this is we don't get training in this, and you can have powerful emotions come up. In fact, it's part of the process in some ways. If you take away distraction and stimulation, you are likely to come across some material that's not all great. So we do have to be respectful of that. It can be
very much so. Yes, exactly. Very much so.
I want to push that a bit further. I think in my experience and observation, that the sort of positive silence that we're both talking about here cannot happen unless it is voluntary. We know that people who are put into solitary confinement go bonkers.
Mm.
You know, it's got to be something that you choose for yourself. It helps if you choose a place where other people will help you structure it, like a retreat, when you begin. But I don't believe that locking people up and forcing them to be solitary is going to do much good.
Mm. No, I'm sure that's right. Let's take a couple more calls too. Wilbur from South Australia. Hi, Wilbur.
Yes. Hi, Phil.
Hi.
I'm enjoying this conversation very much.
Thank you.
I had a wry smile because my late father, if the bit of racket in the house or whether the TV was on or radio was on, he'd come in and say, right, turn it off and just be with your own thoughts, you know. he used to say, don't be scared of your own thoughts, you know. He was fairly forthright in that sort of way, but it was just amusing how, and I find that I'm doing that with my own kids a bit sometimes, saying, you know, what's that racket on TV, you know, if it's some American sitcom or something where it's that canned laughter and so on, you know. it's a funny thing, but I just thought I'd just pass it on there.
Yeah, no, thank you. The benefits of solitude. Ben, you're 20 and like solitude. See, you some might think that's unusual.
Oh, yeah, mate. It's funny how much flack I got from my mates for not being on my phone enough, though. I think you've fallen off the patient appointment or something for not answering for a few hours. but I met one of the blokes earlier and mentioned about Outward Bound, and I had that experience in year 10 at school out in the Warfel National Park there.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought that was awesome, and I'd love to go back out and do that sort of thing. So.
Yeah, but you cop it from your mates for not being immediately available all the time on your phone.
If you don't respond for a few hours, it'll get spam and people are thinking you're dead or something, like, if you're not on your phone. And I have it in my pocket, sure, because you've got to working out on a farm if something happens or whatever, but yeah. I'm not pulling it out every 5 minutes, responding to people, because I'm looking at what's around me. And it's funny how much more you actually take in. And if something flies past and all the nature stuff, people's first reaction is to pull out your phone and film it rather than actually watch what's going on and take it in. So.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. Thanks, Ben. Daniel in Melbourne. Hi, Daniel.
Hi there. How you going?
Not bad. You did a retreat recently, was it?
Oh, it was a few years back. I did a Vipassana 10-day retreat
right. In
Pomona, and it was an amazing experience. It took me 3 days to really start enjoying it.
Mm.
I wanted to escape within the first 3 days. There was one of the group climbed up a tree, and I think he had a different experience to most other people, and he wanted to be up in a tree alone. But I went through it, and it was an amazing experience, one of the best things I've ever done. I'd love to do it.
Tell me about this, Dan. Tell me, what, you didn't speak at all for 10 days?
So no, there was no radio, no reading, no magazines, no newspapers, no talking, just pretty much 10 hours of meditation throughout the day, 1 hour sittings, and you'd have a break for... We'd wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, get ready and brush our teeth and start the day at 5 o'clock in the morning, and then probably have our last meditation around 6:30, and then have dinner and go to bed. I'd shared a room with one other person, and it was really difficult.
Did you speak? You didn't speak with that person?
Wasn't allowed to. Yeah, wasn't allowed. Wasn't even allowed to do any exercise. I really like to keep fit, but wasn't even allowed to do push-ups or any exercise, but it was very difficult.
Phil, I'd add to that Vipassana's rules, there's not even eye contact, because you realise that a lot of communication goes on with eye contact. So the idea is that you are supposed to treat your retreat as, it's just you, strip everything else away.
What did you come out of that with, Daniel, apart from an immense desire to talk to someone, probably?
I thought it was just a really deep experience for me. I got, strangely connected to my food. That was probably the only simulation I had throughout the day was the food that I was eating.
Mm.
And it was beautiful vegetarian food. It was a meat-free diet. But I was just so thankful for everything that was on my plate, every rice grain, every lentil, every toast, the plate, the utensils, the tables, the chairs. I was so thankful that, there was more than, me. There was a whole bunch of people involved in me having this meal. And I just felt really deeply connected to all the people that would have been involved to produce that one lunch for me on that day, or one breakfast or one dinner. So I actually got quite emotional in that experience.
Wow.
I have a section in my book that describes exactly that.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Was the same for you, Christine?
Yeah, I was saying that I have a section, a chapter in my book about my Vipassana experience, and that food relationship is exactly as Daniel just explained, because it's because suddenly, you're stripped away of lots and lots of distraction and stimuli. Suddenly your food, you are appreciating your food. You're not wolfing it down, talking, doing work on a computer, reading, doing any other. So you're there and you're savouring these wonderful tastes. Yes, I had a very similar experience.
What did you come out of it with, though? Did you, apart from, I can understand that heightened attention to any stimulation, and the food, of course, is stimulation. But what did you come out of? Did you come out of it with a desire to speak less or to interact less, or what?
I think it changed. I can quite happily say it changed my life, because it reset some habits, but it also enabled me to see the way thoughts and emotions arise, and that we don't have to attach to ourselves to them. Tim Ferriss, who wrote the 4-hour work week and hosts a wonderful podcast, he describes it as being one, normally you're inside the washing machine. you know, being tumbled around. Your thoughts are like the washing inside the washing machine, and you're inside it with them. And all that a practice like Vipassana does is show you how you can sit, if you have a front loader, 6 inches the other side of that door, and you can see, you can observe, you know that there are still all these thoughts tumbling around, what the Buddhists call the monkey mind, but you don't necessarily have to get swept up in them. And once you've experienced that at a deep level, and in an experience like a Vipassana retreat, while you're still very capable of, you know, getting swept up in day-to-day life, what I find it's done is it stays with me. It's allowed me to recognize, you know, for example, when I sit in front of my computer because I have to write something for a deadline, and the next minute, you know, my thoughts might be saying, oh, you really need to research this, or go and check social media, or, you know, you're not very good at this anyway, or all those sorts of stories that we tell each other, we tell ourselves. I can recognize that that's actually just monkey mind. There it is. Off it goes. I don't have to listen to it. I don't have to be aware of it, involved in it. And similarly, Phil, I think one of the things, as Philip, one of the things that silence generally does, interestingly, is that when we do come to speak, I think most of us become better listeners, because it slows us down and it allows us to, because you're more sensitive to the environment, it allows you to just let words, let another person, let their words flow, let another person communicate to you. And when you think about what the modern world does to us most of the time, Twitter being a great example, it's that, you know, quick, you've got to throw your opinion in there, throw, you know, make another statement, react. Silence teaches you that you have the luxury to simply allow other people to speak and to listen and to take an interest in what they're saying before you respond.
Yep. Okay. All right. Adam,
you don't sound convinced, Philip.
No. I'm intrigued because I suppose it's far from generally my experience, but that's because perhaps I make a living generally from talking with people, and that's the way it rolls for me. Adam, g'day.
Oh, hi, mate. How are you?
Yeah, not bad.
I just like to say that I find at least 4 to 5 hours a day to myself. If I don't, I find that quite opposite. Like, a lot of people like to pick up their phones or watch television, and that's how they enjoy their day. But I enjoy my day by finding that silence and peace, and you can actually slow the whole world down if you can sit down and actually find your inner peace within yourself. And silence is golden if you can do that.
Yes. Okay. Maybe that's the meaning of that phrase as well. Well, Sarah, if you go to a city, Sarah, do you get discombobulated in the extreme?
Do I get what? Sorry.
Do you get very discombobulated?
Very dis. I can't hear you.
No, that's okay. Do you find cities very stressful?
Yes, I do. But as I don't go there very often and always go to see people because I love them, it has a spin-off. I mean, you know, it's a balance. I do find, one of the things, I always get drunk whenever I go to a city. And I don't get drunk when I'm at home. And I do find it stressful. But I also, I want to be a bit careful about this. I'm not spending Palmo sitting for 12 years in a cave on a hill and speaking to no one.
No.
I am, for instance, speaking to you.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. Look, we're going to have to wind it up because time has beaten us, but it's been an interesting conversation. Thank you to all the people who contributed to it as well. I've been speaking with Sarah Maitland. Sarah is author of A Book of Silence and How to Be Alone. Christine Jackman's also been our guest, author of Turning Down the Noise, The Quiet Power of Silence in a Busy World. And thanks for all your contributions too.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.